Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. If you are looking at or you're watching this episode, please leave a review. And if you're listening to it, a review will work there too. So today, my guest is Val Grubb. She's an author, speaker, trainer, and coach. I started learning about DISC recently, and she's a DISC facilitator too. She's had quite an interesting journey, having marketing, R&D, and operations roles before embarking on her current path. So how does someone with a mechanical engineering degree end up as a DISC facilitator, among other things? Well, let's find out. Welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Val.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here, Neil. It is a big, varied journey along the way, for sure.
100%. So I mentioned that you studied mechanical engineering. What was the motivation to do that?
I don't know, great in math and science. Those were my, two favorite and best subjects in high school. And my brother went to Kettering University. It was General Motors Institute in Flint, Michigan. He studied industrial engineering. And I thought, I kind of like what he's doing. And I thought, let me try that. That seems like a great path for me to go forward. And so I also followed my brother to Kettering or General Motors Institute, Kettering now. And my major is mechanical. And then I had a minor in electrical engineering. And my co-op sponsor was a division of General Motors, Allison Gas Turbine. And then it was sold to Rolls-Royce. So it was Rolls-Royce Aircraft.
Oh, cool. But I also saw from your background, you got an MBA as well. So what was the motivation to get the MBA?
I was at Rolls-Royce for 11 years total, co-oping for 5 and then 6 full time. And during that time, I was already moving out of a hardcore engineering role and into more businessy type roles. I went into R&D marketing and then was promoted and went into public affairs, which means that I would, represent Rolls-Royce at all the trade shows and things like this. And so it was kind of really morphing into that business side of things. And I just felt that an MBA would help me because that wasn't a lot, really my big focus in undergrad. And so I was really looking to hone my skills. And I have to admit, I have always been very thankful of receiving that MBA. It was also, to me, my company, Rolls-Royce was paying for it. I'd have to pay for it up front and then take the class and get a certain grade and then I would be reimbursed. And to me, like that's money left on the table. And so to me, that seemed like a promotion or a little bit of a cash incentive. So I definitely wanted to take advantage of that. So yeah, the knowledge, it's also in my mind, it was almost like a little bonus for me that the company offered.
You mentioned that you started off in engineering and then you moved into these businessy roles. Is that something that you were planning to do? Or is that something the company asked you to do?
Boy, that's a great question, Neil. What was really where my interest, I think that my interest kind of went that route. Because I, again, kind of starting off in hardcore engineering, the question was, where did I see myself in 5 or 10 years? And it was way more on the business sales side of things versus what I had been doing, which was in aircraft engine design and test. And it just really was as I got to know the many facets of engineering, it was just, like I said, it was really where my path led me. And by the way, I mean, that's really, I was at Rolls-Royce for 11 years, and because I had pivoted into more of a business side of things, that's what allowed me to pivot to a completely different industry of going into entertainment and helping to found a couple companies because I had that technical background. So I was able to really get in and understand the details, but then be able to apply the business or the strategy. So I could get tactical at the same time adding strategy. And so that having that dual, you know, very hardcore tactical from the engineering helped me as I then moved over and moved from Indiana to California, moved industries, went to work for a gentleman, Barry Diller, to help found a company called IAC. And I was head of operations and then was with him for 3 years. He moved me to New York, and I was in Manhattan to help found the Oxygen Channel, the women's cable channel. Again, same thing, head of operations. And I think that technical background gave me the process rigor to figure out back office operations in an organization that's just starting up, while at the same time understand the business side. So it was a nice combination of both. And I think I was interested in it. Rolls-Royce let me do it. And then I leaned into it heavy from moving into, moving into different corporate roles. So sorry, it was a long-winded answer. I'm an engineer after all, but there's a lot behind that, I think. A lot behind that.
Yeah, 100%. Well, obviously, yes. It was quite a detailed answer.
Yeah. So, but I think it's important to understand the journey. And that's the thing, like having an engineering degree or having a technical degree, you can pivot that to so many things. Like having that technical degree. And that's part of something that I looked at when I looked at what was I going to go get as a solid undergrad degree. Getting an engineering degree, like that'll help me in anything. And any job out there, it will help you.
Yeah, I fully agree. Once you get an engineering degree, people will probably look at you and think, whatever you're doing, they'll figure it out.
Right. Neil, you nailed it. You nailed it, Neil. 100%.
But certainly going from Rolls Royce to Oxygen, that's quite the transition. So
right, yeah. And then I started my own company. So your question, how did I get to DISC? So when we sold Oxygen Media, I went to NBC Universal as the VP of operations again, hardcore operations for 6 months, really focused on mergers and acquisitions for NBC, but really just didn't like it. And I'd been wanting to go out on my own. And that's what I did. I went out in consulting. And at that point, you know, when I was at, I went into consulting in setting up operations, like pulling out companies, setting up company operations if you were going to sell them, integrating companies if you bought a company, figuring out, you know, where are you going to pay bills from? Are you going to do payroll? What are you going to do with benefits and all this sort of stuff? And I did that for about the first 7 years of my company's existence. Then as the economy got better, because I started in 2008, so consulting was the rage. As the economy got better, my clients now started coming in and asking me, well, you helped us set up the company. Can you now help train our leaders to be more strategic? And that was really when I went in and got DISC certified. And got DISC, I'm an authorized partner as well. So I can, you know, sell the DISC assessments kind of thing. So that's really how it just became of what my clients were asking for. And so I put, you know, it was worthwhile because it's also great when I go in and consult with companies now, if I'll consult with the CEO and her, his direct reports, I'll have them all do DISC. So I kind of know what sort of style we're starting with. So again, that's kind of how I got involved in DISC, and it's been a good thing for my consulting practice.
Yeah, I mentioned in the intro that I've been doing some readings on DISC, and it really made me understand the differences between people and just how they take in whatever you say.
Right.
And I never, yeah. It was never something that I thought of really. I recently started with these calls that I've been having, just regular networking calls. asking people, are you the type of person that likes to jump right into the nitty gritty of the conversation, whatever the agenda is, or do you like to build rapport first? And the question always kind of makes them chuckle, because I highly doubt anyone's ever asked them that before, but they answer, it's like, no, rapport first. Okay, well then, how are you doing
and
today?
You know, they're either a D or an I. Chances are they're a D or an I in the disc. Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so isn't that, I mean, I think anytime we find out information, you know, about ourselves, it's a data point. Is it the be all end all? Never. But is it a data point? And I think that's great. So, and I think it's also a little bit about, which I think, you know, folks in tech fields are very good at, is continuing to learn. Because we have that thirst for knowledge as how technology just continues to change. And so we already are kind of hardwired to want to stay cutting edge. And we have to do it about ourselves too, you know, about finding out about ourselves as well. Things like DISCs, things like emotional intelligence, all of that just helps us learn, continue that journey of learning.
Yeah, I fully agree with you, Val. I mean, I mentioned in the intro that you're a speaker. What do you typically speak about?
Leadership. So I really focus on leadership, and that's pretty broad. I get it. Pretty broad. But it's everything from, you know, getting out of the weeds and into the strategy to being better at negotiations, to being able to project manage your time for the day to day. It's hardcore influencing without authority. It's, you know, again, it's leading from the chair you're in. It's about things about like growing your personal brand. So really anything to do with is about elevating employees from tactical thinking to more strategic leadership. And that's from the chair that they're in. And I've really been speaking even since my Oxygen days, and even before that as well. Like, to me, having an opportunity to share your knowledge is a fantastic thing. It's a fantastic thing for your career. Now it is my career, because now what I get, I'm a paid, that's all I do is get paid to speak either through keynotes, through corporate training, and then I do executive coaching, which kind of gets into the consulting side of things. But, you know, it's a great thing to start doing right now. If you're in corporate America, volunteer, you raise your hand to do that speaking, because it helps get better, and then it will help you, who knows, eventually, if you're interested, to eventually get paid for it.
When it comes to leadership, do you think that leaders should have a leadership style, or should they lead based on how the people they're leading want to be led?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think you have to adapt, you know, it's back to a little bit of that servant leadership. In my mind, as having led thousands of employees, my job is to unleash the greatness in all the employees who work for me. And that does mean that I have to adapt my leadership to being the best leader for each of my employees. And that does mean it changes based on what their attitude is. It changes on where their skill level is. And, you know, is it 100% that way? Probably not, but it's about 75%. Because it really comes from, as you think about leadership, what do they need from me in order to give their best every day? And so that needs me thinking about that. Now, if somebody, you know, let's say somebody comes and says, Val, you're being too micromanaging. Okay, all right, fair comment. I'm being micromanaging because we haven't built up enough trust so that I feel like I can let you go and, you know, work on your own and get this project done. So how can you give me more updates to know that it's going on, know that it's getting done, and yet I don't have to come back and get into your knickers? So, you know, again, it's, you know, is it 100% me adjusting? No. Not if I cannot, if there's an issue that I need to come back and manage. But it is understanding that if I'm micromanaging somebody and it's killing them, then let's talk about how I can step away, how you can keep me posted that will allow me to step away. So again, that's why I say it's about 75% adjusting to them, but there's also 25% of the fact that, you know, I still need, like, I need information. What I need matters as well. So it's a combination. I hate to say it. It's not 100% black and white. There's a lot of gray, I think, in leading people.
You know, when you were talking, Valerie, it made me think about equity and how big that is in the workplace these days. So if you're a leader and you have a number of direct reports, if you're going to partially lead them based on how they want to be led, is there ever instances where one direct report might say, well, you're leading them differently and that's not equitable because it's way different than how you're leading me? And I don't see that as being fair. What do you think about that?
I think the key is it's not about, I mean, equity is about meeting people where they're at. So, you know, it's, you know, I mean, certain people, like, you know, if I think about, if I hire somebody at a director level who has less experience, so who has less experience versus I've got another director that's got a boatload of experience, I can't treat them the same. And so I have to meet that director where they're at. And it is like, I have to meet them. I could tell you this. I've never had somebody say to me, you're leading them differently. I have had somebody say, you favor somebody more. And I said, all right, tell me a little bit more about that. And it was because, which by the way, was very true. You have lunch with this person on a weekly basis, yet I'm not included in that. And it was like, holy cow, you're absolutely right. And so I did make adjustments about where I, because, you know, you pick up things in, it certainly wasn't planned, but it just happened, that this person came in after the fact and we had a, you know, a weekly routine of going out to lunch. And so I included this person from then on to make sure that they got more of the spotlight, that they got as much casual time with me as I was giving. But I've never had somebody come up and say that I'm leading differently. Because again, it is about every employee. It's based on their skill versus their attitude. If you treat everybody the same, I'm assuming that everybody's at the same level. And I think that's a tough thing to assume if I've got an employee who needs more help and I'm not willing to give them more help in order for them to succeed. I mean, take an example. Like if I've got somebody who's led employees for a long time and they have, meaning they have direct reports, I don't have to spend as much time with them on how to motivate and engage their employees because they know how to do it. But if I come back and promote somebody to being a manager, to now managing people, if I promote one of my direct reports and they now need to manage people, their skill level is not at the same level. So I'm going to have to help them more. Now I can't do that, to your point, Neil, I can't do that to the exclusion that I don't help my superstar, but I've got to make sure that I give that other person who needs help, I've got to be there for them. I don't know. Like I said, I can tell you that that's what I have found in my managing of lots and lots of employees.
You know, when you're speaking, Val, that example you gave of the direct report that said you favored this other person and because you never invited them to the lunch as well, it just, I don't know, that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. They it's because they're coming to you with a complaint as opposed to a request. Perhaps they could have just asked, could I be included in these lunches?
Well, what it was is, in this specific example, they were included in the lunches. It was just at a time that they had a standing meeting with on a project. So, and we just never thought of adjusting, you know, we just kind of did the same routine, but absolutely this person was invited to the lunch but we didn't make accommodations to make sure that this person was able to attend. And you know what? I can't, let me say this, that how I found this out was my asking, how can I be a better leader for you? And the comment was, well, I'd like a little more time with you, like the time that you give to employee A. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Because it feels like because I meet with them individually at same amount of time. And the comment was, well, you actually go out to lunch with this employee every week. And it was like, yes, I do. And I'm like, why don't you join us? Well, because it's this standing time. And I said, we will change that. And we changed it from Friday to Thursday. So it wasn't, that didn't rub me the wrong way. I asked the question, how can I be a better leader? And when somebody says to me, well, I'd like the same. And let me say, I can tell you this, Neil, that from then on, I paid way more attention to who I was spending casual time with. Because again, back to your comment about equity, spending casual time with the boss, I have to be equitable about that. And I have to give the opportunity. And yes, of course, I asked them, but I made no adjustment. And so it was a big eye-opener for me at that moment that I need to be thinking of that, because time with the boss is valuable. And you learn things with the boss. It's, you know, it's, I used to be, you know, at Rolls Royce, the guys would go out and play golf, and I hated playing golf, so I didn't go. And I missed a lot of good time with my boss, a lot of good casual FaceTime. So I eventually took it up and hated every second that I spent on that golf course. But I did it because it made time to get FaceTime, the same amount of FaceTime with my boss. So I try not to, when you ask people how to be a better boss, which I do on a quarterly basis with my employees, even to this day, if they tell me something, I can't come back and get mad at that. I don't have to do it. I don't have to do anything different. But if I've asked for feedback, I have to come back and listen to it. And this employee was right. This employee was right. We needed to adjust to make sure that they had as much casual FaceTime, just like back to that golf course. Well, you know, it was, I didn't have the option to go to a movie or do something else with my boss. I had to adjust to my boss. I think it's worthwhile as a boss to try to adjust to make sure, again, back to your equitable question, that I don't pick, you know, if I have an employee who doesn't drink and doesn't want to go to the bar, and we happen to, you know, one of our team activities is to go to the bar, and for whatever reason, they have an issue going to bars, I need to be mindful of that. And I need to think about, maybe we go out for coffee, maybe we go out for ice cream. There's so many other things that I can do to adjust what I do to make sure that everybody's included.
Indeed. So does that mean that if one person of, say, 10 direct reports doesn't want to go to the bar, but everyone else wants to go, I guess the bar ain't it. We got to go find and do something else. It has to be 100% buy-in or nothing.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but it's never 100%. Somebody's always going to be mad, whatever you do. I do have a tendency to do majority rule, but I can't have that activity the same every time. Why not? And by the way, you know, I mean, again, and this is a scenario that I've run into that I had an employee whose practices couldn't go to a bar. You know, that's just not something that this person would want to do. And that, you know, did that mean it stopped me from going to the bar? Absolutely not. But I made sure that we also did lunches during the day, that we did other things. We would go to a museum, by the way, that had a bar, but yet we could go to a museum and this person's going to a museum. So it's just about being more creative, I think. And, you know, I mean, this person worked for me. I want them to do the best for me. So if they're doing their best, I win ultimately. And I think it's just being a little more mindful versus, well, you'll never be able to go to the bar with us. Good luck. Sorry about that. I just think that you know, we can be somewhat accommodating, but, you know, 100%, maybe not. But I think if there's a workaround, we need to think about it. I mean, I say this because, you know, we had an employee who was in a wheelchair. Like, I can tell you, you know, we wanted to, before this person hired in, we'd do some crazy stuff like, you know, those teams things where you're hiking through the woods and stuff like that. We couldn't do that anymore because now we had somebody who was in a wheelchair. So we had to think about, I'm not going to exclude this person. I need to figure out how I can involve this person. And yet what's the goal of us hiking through the woods and figuring out a more creative way that we could include this person? Because I can't go, you know, stalking through the woods and swinging from tires and stuff like this, or playing paintball or whatever. So, like I said, I just think, again, back to this idea of equity, you have to be mindful. Can everybody participate? Is this something everybody wants to do? You know, again, maybe we go to the bar once, but if there's a way to accomplish team building in other ways that doesn't involve the bar, then, you know, add that into the repertoire.
Nice. You know, Val, when it comes to this channel, it started because of my own struggles giving presentations in front of others. And then I started doing these interviews with people that have technical backgrounds like myself. And it turns out they had similar struggles, but they overcame them like I did. But for the people who are watching or listening to this, our conversation, if they want to get better at giving presentations or just public speaking generally, what would your number one tip be?
Gosh, number one. All right. It may be a number one with parts A through C. I think the biggest thing is that think about the audience. Everything starts with the audience. What do you need the audience to do for you, to feel, to believe, and then work backwards from there? It's not about what you want to tell them. It's about what your goal in presenting to them based on the people that are there. So people that are senior levels, they're going to have different decisions than somebody who's your boss. So start with that audience, start with who they are, what they know, what they're going to need to know in order to make a decision, and then whittle that down to its bare essentials. If you're told you have 20 minutes to present, cut that in half. And how do you, don't tell people the how of doing your job is not relevant. It's what did that result in? What was the result of that 6 months worth of work? And give them the results for senior level folks so that they can make decisions. So really start with the audience. Think about not what you want to deliver, but what they need to know in order for them to think, feel, or do what you want them to do. And then cut your time in half. And the last piece I'll say is to practice. You get in front of somebody who can give you solid advice on how to, are you presenting in a manner that's going to convince them? And what can you cut? What can you do differently? I find that it's only through practice really for me, and practice in front of a tough audience is what made me better. Because I'm so caught up in what I want to say that I forget that I'm rambling. Or they're like, Val, this is not necessary. Stop whatever you're talking about. Get to the point. And a tough audience can get you back on track, presenting to the audience and telling them what they need to know.
100%. Yeah, I'm definitely in that get to the point type. Yeah. I'm for your people in the audience. And it really is. It does irk me sometimes when people go off on these points. And
like, enough. And the problem now is, now you're on your phone. The moment you've lost them, you've lost them, and it's tough to get them back.
Yep. You're on the phone.
Tough to get them back.
You're on your phone. You're staring off into space. You're thinking about what you're going to have for lunch, all kind of things.
Oh, anything but actually listening.
This has been a great conversation.
A million things going on. Well, hopefully I know I rambled on a bit, Neil. So hopefully you haven't been contemplating your lunch during our discussion.
Oh, I already knew what I was going to have before we even started. I'm having Thai food today. We're going for some green curry.
That sounds absolutely awesome. That sounds way better than whatever I'm going to have. I can tell you that.
Wonderful. This has been a great conversation, Val. Thank you so much for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you?
You can, I have a website, valgrubandassociates.com. It has a contact form on there, as well as my email is vgrub@valgrubandassociates.com as well. So, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn, LinkedIn and Instagram and all those good things as well. So that sounds great.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And if you want to know more about that, you can go to teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Val.
Thanks, Neil.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms, or on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.